Everyone, today we're still waiting for a few people. We're going to go ahead and start because we have some students from Eagle River High School, and I'm so glad that you all came. Hello over there. And I know they have a bus to catch, so we want to go ahead and just start as soon as we can. We have a lot of great programs coming up here in the winter and the spring. You will see some brochures and flyers on your table. Please feel free to take some. It's an amazing lineup. I'm so excited. There's more information about all these programs on our website. We also have them up on our Facebook. Hopefully you are one of our friends on Facebook. We are posting things all the time about conference calls. We just had one with Vicente Fox, the former president of Mexico. So if you're not on our Facebook page, fix that. And you can join us on Twitter. We have some people here who are tweeting and keeping this conversation going viral. So please join us in that conversation too. And while you do that, if you wouldn't mind switching on your phone to vibrate. We do love those ringtones, but we are recording for KSKA today. So if you could just put your phone on vibrate, that'd be great. The program will be available for listening. You can send it to your friends or you can hear it again. You'll find a link on our website, or you can find that on Alaska Public Media's website at alaskapublic.org. We are supported by our memberships. Are you a member of the World Affairs Council? If you are, raise your hand. Oh, wow. Fantastic. Thank you so much for supporting the World Affairs Council. You know, we have been here longer than Alaska has been a state, and it's because of people like you that we're able to do what we do. And if you're not a member, please consider joining the Alaska World Affairs Council today. There are cards on the table, and we have a special offer that you can get a free guest pass and bring a friend if you become a member. So please consider joining and bring a friend and letting them know. Your membership allows us to do things like what we did today, thanks to our speaker. We've been keeping him busy. He just came from speaking at West High School. He spoke to the Russian immersion class. I have no idea what he said, but they were laughing, and so I think the jokes were on color. I have no idea, but they really appreciated his time. And then he spoke for the general student body during their lunch hour about opportunities, and so we really appreciate him doing that. He also got up early yesterday morning as well and went to J-Bear to speak to our military leaders about Russia's involvement in the Arctic and what Putin is thinking and not thinking. And that was also really appreciated. So thank you for our speaker for doing that and for all of you guys for making this possible. Another way you can support the Alaska World Affairs Council is through Pick, Click, and Give. It is that time. If you have not applied for yours, March 31st is the deadline. So do that and consider clicking on Alaska World Affairs Council for your donation. Speaking of support, I would like to thank Steve Zelliner very much. He is a former board member of the World Affairs Council. Steve, would you mind standing? He made this program possible today, and Steve, we really appreciate all that you do for us over the years and this program. Thank you very, very much. And we are excited about our Student High School Academic World Quest competition, which was last weekend here at the Dedina Center. It's where students are competing on things like foreign affairs, current events. Unbelievable students this year. It was really a competitive competition. And the winning team of four gets a trip paid to Washington, D.C. to compete at the national level. And this year, it was taken away by a team of students who came from a school that we've been trying to get to come for a while, and they haven't. The teacher hasn't put together a team. And finally, a group of students said, you know what, we are just going anyways, and they won. And they are from Diamond High School, and they are phenomenal. So congratulations. Oh, she's here. Who's here? One of the students. Stand up, please. There you are. Wow. Good luck in Washington, D.C. in April competing. We're going to be watching you and seeing how Alaska do. You make us very proud. Speaking of students, do we have any other students? Would you also mind standing? We want to recognize the students that are here today, and thank you so much for coming. So please stand, our students. And I want to thank BP for sponsoring the student lunches. This is the 10th year that BP has been doing that. So thank you, BP, for the sponsorship and for all the students for coming. And right now, I would like to go on with our program and introduce the two gentlemen on the stage here. To my immediate right, we have our moderator today, Russ Howell, who is the former director of the American-Russian Center at UAA. From 1993 to 2009, the American-Russian Center conducted more than 2,200 business training, civil society development, and educational exchange programs in Anchorage through 7 small business training centers in the Russian Far East. In that 16-year period, over 60,000 participants and entrepreneurs completed ARC training courses on a variety of topics from banking to retail sales, airport management, and marketing. Prior to his time at UAA, Russ served 21 years as infantry officer and a foreign area officer in the U.S. Army, analyzing events in the former Soviet Union for senior military and civilian leaders in Washington, D.C. He's also a member of the World Affairs Council, and we're so pleased to have you today as a moderator. And to his right, we have our speaker, Captain Yuri Tabak, who was born in Moscow, USSR, and lived there until 1976, when his family immigrated to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and he met Steve Zelliner in high school. I'm sure there's going to be some great stories with that. Upon graduation from Temple University School of Pharmacy in 1985, he was commissioned an ensign in the U.S. Navy captain. Captain Tabak holds the distinction of being the first Soviet-born citizen to be commissioned an officer in the Armed Forces of the United States. Captain Tabak's Navy career, yes, is a highly distinguished one, serving a number of critical roles over the past 2 decades. In 91, Captain Tabak was assigned to the Department of State as advisor to the U.S. Ambassador and Special Presidential Envoy to the former Soviet Union, which I believe he was kicked out of. Is that right? It doesn't say that on here. Yes, that was the first time he was kicked out, if there's any questions. His next role was in the U.S. Embassy in Moscow as a member of the Prisoner of War, Missing in Action Commission. The organization searched for U.S. POWs and MIAs in the former Soviet Union. Captain Tabak then served as a Chief Military Information Officer for the United Nations Military Observer Mission in Georgia. His team successfully negotiated the hostage release of personnel. Captain Tabak served as chief in the Arms Control Implementation Unit at the U.S. Embassy in Almaty, Kazakhstan. Throughout the 2000s, Captain Tabak served as a program manager in the Defense Threat Reduction Office at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, and then as a naval affairs officer at the U.S. Embassy in Warsaw, Poland. Then, from 2006 to 2008, he acted as the first U.S. deputy director at the Defense Against Terrorism Center of Excellence in Ankara, Turkey. There, he led an international staff of 90 officers from 7 different NATO countries. Captain Tabak served as chief staff for the NATO military liaison mission in Moscow. There, he acted as the liaison between NATO's military committee and the military of defense of the Russian Federation. He retired from the Navy in 2011. Captain Tabak is here today to speak to us about checkmate, predictions on Russia's maneuvering and the U.S. response. Please join me in a warm welcome of our speaker today.
That clarify one thing. I was not an Army captain or Air Force captain. I was a real captain in the Navy.
Yeah, and Yuri, we have somebody over here who's watching, so you're going to have to watch it today. Actually, the way we got Yuri here is we told him we were bringing him to the boat show downstairs. So. Thank you very much, Lisa. I appreciate the introductions. And again, thank you all for allowing me to participate in this event today. And thank you, Yuri, for coming. So my job is initially to sort of to get the ball rolling a little bit, to ask some hopefully pertinent questions and get some responses. And we'll do that for a little while, and then we'll open it up to the floor for your questions. So since the focus of our activities today is sort of the checkmate, Russia and the United States. As you are probably aware, the Russians are great, great chess players. They have some of the world's best chess players. So this is an appropriate analogy, I think, for the relationship between the United States and Russia. So I would first like to, the first question I'd like to ask is for Yuri perhaps to talk a little bit about Russia, President Putin, and sort of how Russia sees its relationship with the United States. So. Tap it. There you go.
That's an easy subject, you know. Hello? Yeah? All right, so maybe Putin is already on top of it. No, he's like turning my microphone. They tapped.
Yeah, I wonder if these microphones are wired
server,
to the internet.
To the server, yeah. I hope you change your passwords, peoples. Because the last one wasn't difficult to break, you know? Hillary won, exclamation mark. It's not so difficult. Actually, I was asked not to speak politics, you know, not to mention his name too often. So I don't know how do you talk about Russian-American relations without mentioning or praising the president of the United States. So it's going to be difficult. Yes, I think Russia has viewed and, you know, Putin is a KGB thug. And you can take the boy out of KGB, you can never take KGB out of a boy. So he's a tricky guy, he's a conniving guy, he's short, our president is tall, you know. He's got no hair, our president got lots of hair. Our president has money or pretends to have a lot of money and he spends it and he shows it. Putin definitely has a lot of money, but can't show it because it's all stolen, you know. So there's a lot of clashes between them. There's a lot of differences between them, different personalities. Nevertheless, I think Putin took advantage of us in the last 10 years or so by testing us with Georgia and invading Georgian territory first, and then when he saw that there was no reaction or no punishment for him, you know, he continued to do so once the economy declined. He continued to do so to rally his people, to get the nationalism going. He invaded and annexed part of Ukraine, which he and us and I believe France and Great Britain guaranteed that if they would give up nuclear weapons to Russia, we were guaranteed that the borders would stay intact. But I'm not going to tell you things that you already know. So I think that in the last 10 years or so, that Putin felt that we're weak, that our leadership is weak, that we're not controversial, we're not going to get into a fight, we're not going to stand our ground, and he took advantage of it. And that is why his move towards Arctica was made, because we stopped patrolling this area in the last 10 years. I don't know if Commander could correct me if I'm wrong. The same thing with China. We stopped patrolling it. Our forces became very thin. We're not taking an aggressive posture than he does. You know how it is. If you don't buy flowers for your wife, somebody else will. It's guaranteed. I know. I was in the Navy for 30 years. I've seen it happen. So if you don't do it, somebody else will. And the Chinese start building islands and extending their territory, and so did Putin. You know, if nobody is in Arctica, boom, I am. If there is Section 18, you're all aware of Section 18, right? Yeah, Section 12, right? You're Senator, Section 12, you can't develop this region. You can't develop the Northern Seas and the Arctic and the Alaska. You can't pump anything out of it. You can't take anything out of it. It was Section 12, and your Senator is very outspoken about it. And it is for the environmental protection, and I'm all for environment because you have a beautiful area here. It's beautiful. It should be preserved. However, if we're not going to develop it, Russians will. And if you think their technology is environmentally friendly or they care about it, then I know who you voted in your last elections. So they will develop it. They'll come in, but they don't have the knowledge. Their ambitious plans never play out, never work out. And I feel, and if, you know, it says I'm going to predict things. So here's my prediction. I feel that they won't be able to do it. So what they're going to do? They're going to call in Chinese, and they're going to subcontract it to the Chinese. And Chinese very efficiently will pump everything out of here. And then we will buy it from them. This is what's been happening. This is what's been happening in our military. We haven't been developing in the last 10 or so years many of minerals and valuable things out of the earth in order to preserve it. And we lost the technology. Chinese have not. So now for our weaponry, for our precision weapons, we have to buy those elements from the Chinese. So Section 12 is really not good, because look, it's because Section 8 comes before Section 12. You know what Section 8 is? It's housing for its projects. So I think our former president said, look, 8 comes before 12, so you have to take care of Section 8 before you take care of Section 12. You have to feed and take care of the poor before you develop the economy. And you capitalist pigs, I'm sorry, I get carried away sometimes. You capitalists think the opposite. You think that first you have to develop the economy and then to, you know, take care of the poor. Alaska, I don't think, will go anywhere if you try to prevent progress. You can't stop progress. You have to develop things. You have to dig what you have, what belongs to you. Otherwise, someone else will do it. What? How did he say? Who's it? Confucius confused this thing. He says, if you give a man a fish, you'll feed him, and if you give a man a rod, what is it? He feeds himself, right? Did I get it right? It doesn't apply for
Russia. I think it was somebody a little bit later than Confucius, though.
Oh, well, I don't know. But
he used to live in Palestine, as I recall.
It's the figures to do. Where the problem is. So the I think it's wrong. I think it's confusing people, because if Russians come to develop things here, have you ever, you know, it doesn't matter if you give Russians a rod and a hook and the bait and stuff like this. That's not how they go fishing. Did anybody go fishing with the Russians here? Yeah, right. What, they don't take this. They take a grenade. That's how they fish. It's very effective. Get plenty of fish, but not very environmentally, maybe friendly. So I don't know if I answered your question, but you do have a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful state. Irene and I wanted to come here for a long time. And then, you know, we were spent much time in Miami, in Florida. And my wife said, there's no way she's going to Alaska in February. So Steve and I, we went to private high school, yeah. My wife went to Philadelphia public school, thank God. Because I told her, I said, you see, it's a time difference. When there is a winter here, it's a summer there. When it's a summer, because instead of geography in her school, they had race relations or something like that, they substituted. So she says, great. So when we landed here, we walked out, she said, they got a crappy summer here, I tell you. So thank God for public schools. And I use VA, thank God for the VA, for the public medicine, too. It's good.
We've read a lot about Putin in the papers, and the information that we get is that Putin is genuinely popular in Russia. Could you talk a little bit about sort of that dynamic, please, in Russia?
Oh, absolutely. He's popular. He's very popular. He's very, very, very good guy. For the Russians, he rallies the patriotism. The Russians are getting off their knees. You know, again, they're a superpower. They're claiming they're protecting the Russians beyond their borders. They're claiming their ground back. All the foreign leaders are afraid of Russia. He has respect. All these Russians, you know, rallying. It's okay that the economy is not existent, but we're building up our military back to the standards the way. And you just all, you know, he wrestles really well. You know, how many of you have seen his picture? You know, with a torso and a horse. I mean, how could you not like the guy? He's very good guy. You like him. He's a true leader. He's a strong leader. So yes, Russians. You know, it is absolutely correct. I think that 85% of the Russian population has voted for Trump.
That too.
That's Freudian, huh? for Putin. So, but you know, if you're talking about true democracy, that's not how it works, of course, because out of all the television, you know, if every day somebody will be telling you on a television, on, you know, on the internet, on the newspapers. Telling you that Putin, we're all gonna, you know, we're all gonna say, yeah, he's the man. That's just how human nature works. So, they wouldn't lie on the television. So we tend to believe that. Yes, Putin is very popular in Russia, and he has been able to rally people around him.
Okay. It seems over the last couple of years, Russia has been making sort of aggressive moves in Europe. They annexed the Crimea. They've moved into Ukraine. And the justification for doing that Putin has used is that he's been helping save Russian populations in those places who were being abused by the governments of the countries in which they were living at that time. And in response to that, we've imposed sanctions. So it seems to me that's sort of the first move in the chess, or maybe not the first move, but that's the latest move in the checkmate and the chess game, rather, between the United States. Has the American and European response of sanctions been effective against Putin? Is that how we should respond? And if so, how can we make those more effective? If not, what should we be doing in order to achieve some sort of defense against these aggressive moves by Russia?
Well, I think, and again, that's my opinion, that the sanctions that we applied are really meaningless and petty. The sanctions that Europeans applied, they're also so far. It only actually got Russians rally around him even more, saying, oh, you're against us, you know, this. The more hurtful to the Russians turned out to be the counter-sanctions, the ones that Putin himself applied to the Europeans. But this is all kind of, it's not, I wouldn't say it's a chess game, it's more of a checker game. It's not very complicated. Because, look, Russians can, you can only get to the Russians two ways. Economically, break down their economy, which you don't have to do it. We don't have to do it because it's already broken beyond repair, the corruption and all this. And the other thing, and it's not really insane, the other thing, the only thing that Russians understand is strength, is force, is brutality. That's how they are. Whoever is stronger, whoever can beat the other one into submission, that's the one that's stronger. And this is why they're so proud and they're so, you know, oh yes, Putin is great. He's building up our military. We're going to be strong. They're actually kind of behind in times thinking that it's a military force that will, that makes you a superpower. But it's not. It's the economy that makes you a superpower. And the Russian economy is equivalent to the Nigerian economy, and the corruption is like in Nigeria, and the bureaucracy is like in Nigeria, and even the population is like in Nigeria, 150 million or so. So Russia is basically Nigeria with snow and nuclear weapons, but I'm not sure if nuclear weapons do work there, because everything that Russians touch usually breaks down and blows up in the wrong place for the wrong time. So, and since we've been financing their nuclear facilities for the last 25 years or so, hopefully when they push the button, it won't fly. I mean, I wouldn't count on it, but it's a possibility. The only weapon Russians have at this point is their veto in the United Nations, veto voice in the Security Council. Otherwise, they're really just rattling with their sabers. And Russ, you know, when we were young officers and we were reading all this intel reports about Russian military, how strong they are, they have thousands of tanks, thousands of airplanes, thousands of this and that. But all of a sudden, Soviet Union collapsed. CIA couldn't predict it somehow. You know. They missed that by a mile. And all of a sudden, Soviet Union collapses, and we realize that those tanks were made out of cardboard, and those missiles were not really missiles. I mean, they're masters of deceive. They tend to make us believe that they have something and they don't, or they tend us to believe that they're going to do something, but they don't do it. So, and right now, they're making us believe that they can blackmail our president, you know, but you can only blackmail or force somebody if we let them do that. If we don't let them do it, they won't. And I think it's a reflection of our former president, because he was a nice guy and Putin was not a nice guy. So not nice guy will take advantage of a nice guy.
Okay. So the response, part of the response to what's been happening in Eastern Europe by NATO and by the United States, I read an article yesterday or saw a report on paper about moving, I think, a tank brigade into Romania. We have another tank brigade in Poland, so it's, and we've deployed a number of Air Force units to the area to patrol the border with between NATO and Russia. Is this kind of the type of response that you think the Russians will understand? Is that likely to be effective, or are there other things that we should be doing to try and counter the moves by Russia?
Well, no, I think that they understand. They do. Our Secretary of Defense, what is it, yesterday, that he says the negotiations we're going to be having with Russians are going to be from a point of force, from a point of strength, and the Russians all get upset about it. And we're showing that. But when, you know, when they get upset about it, that's when they respond. They don't respond to, and it's in their culture, I believe, they don't respond to you when you're nice to them, when you try to have a business negotiation with them. Let's find the win-win situation. No, they don't respond. They actually respond to things that say, look, I'm going to punch you first if you don't back off. And that's why, and we're saying, listen, if you're going to start moving further west, we have tanks here, we have airplanes there, we have armies there, you know, we're going to crush you. And I think, you know, they're listening. They're listening and they're testing us. They're testing this new guy, what, how he's going to respond. Because he's not nice, you know. You all know he's not nice. He's mean. But, you know, they, honest with you, you know, you can't be a nice guy. Leadership does not withstand niceness. You can't be a nice guy to be a leader. You have to be able to make unpopular decisions. You have to be able to take command of the situation. Here we have a commander there. You know, you don't know probably many of people, but I can tell by his uniform, he likes to be in charge. He has had a command ashore and a command at sea. So he likes to command. And he looks like a nice guy, right? But I can assure you, on the board the ship, yeah, he's not a nice guy. You wouldn't want to be friends with him on the ship. And that's a leadership. That's a leadership role. So, yeah, we had a nice guy for a president. Very nice guy. Nice haircut, you know. Nice golf game. Beautiful dance, stuff like that.
I'd like to switch gears a little bit.
Putin wasn't like that. I know. I promised I wasn't going to talk about politics and stuff.
And switch to another area of the world where the United States and Russia seem to be coming at loggerheads, and that's the Middle East. It used to be that the major conflict in the Middle East was the Arab-Israeli conflict, and it seems to be in the last sort of 5 to 10 years to have been subsumed by conflicts between the Shia and the Sunni, between Arab states and Iran, and between so-called moderate Sunnis and Islamic extremists. So I asked you the same question yesterday at one of our meetings. To me, this is like a sort of spaghetti bowl of entanglement and trying to figure out. And then on top of that, we now have the United States and Russia also participating and trying to play a role in this this spaghetti bowl of conflict. So how does the United States react to Russia's involvement in Syria? What should we be doing? And sort of do you see a path out of this entanglement of conflict that we find in the Middle East? An easy question.
Oh, yeah. I mean, can I speak with the Kissinger accent, you know, when I answer? Well, I continue with being non-political again. It goes back again to this nice guy. And and again, Commander can attest it. When you try to be a nice guy and try to please everybody, you're going to piss everybody off. That's going to be the conclusion. And what happened, we end up angering a lot of Sunnis, Shias, Egyptians, Israeli, Koreans, Japanese, Taiwanese. Nobody's happy with us any longer. because we were trying to please them all. And this is where we end up. We end up that Russians in Syria are bombing ISIS and killing some of the what we call moderate opposition, which is another crazy thing, moderate oppositions. The Turks are bombing ISIS and killing Kurds and fighting Assad troops. Syrians are killing the modern opposition, Kurds, and fighting with the Turks. The Kurds feel betrayed by us, who we supported, because they're fighting the ISIS and the Turks, who are allies. And the only common denominator, or only common conclusion that all this mess could come to at the United Nations Security Council, to vote that Israel should contain its aggression against Palestinians and that Jerusalem and the Western Wall are occupied territories. So that's the United Nations conclusion from all that mess. Like, nothing is happening in Syria. It's a mess. How do we... Russians are going to be there. Once Russians get involved in something, they stay there for a long, long time. Because they don't care about losses. They don't care about human loss. Doesn't matter how many coffins are going to go back to their country. And I think this is where this chess game, it's interesting to watch what's going to happen. Because Putin is not going to get out of Syria. He wants Trump to take him seriously. He wants the Western leaders to take him seriously and continue to talk to him, continue to bargain with him. He understands that Trump is now the guy who's going to start the conversation with him and try to bargain things and try to play with him and exchange things. Today, I understand in the Russian Duma, they gave already an order to the Russian mass media to stop praising Trump. So that love affair, I think, has stopped or declined. That honeymoon didn't last too long. So this is the situation we're in. We're in a deep mess. Although in Syria, with all those fighting factions, I personally wish them all success.
Okay.
All of them.
I think we've been listening to me long enough, and so what I'd like to do now is open it up to the audience for your questions, please.
Please, sir. Oh, great. Thank you. Since you took us to Syria, let me follow up with a question. ISIS moved into northern Iraq and took the oil fields in the north, but that wasn't going to be very effective unless they were able to take it to market. And the way they were able to take it to market was trucking it through Turkey. And we looked the other way and we allowed that to happen. And in large part, that's how ISIS built its war chest. Did we make an error? And if so, what should we have done differently?
We made a huge error. We made many errors. We continue to make errors. I think I should be in charge. Then maybe it will stop. So I'll make a stop to stop making mistakes. I think that there's lots of things why these things happen. It's not just one thing or two things. It's a bouquet of diseases that a sailor has. But I think the number one mistake we made, we disbanded the Iraqi army. And we never disbanded even the Japanese army or the German army after World War II. We kept the army intact so they could maintain order inside of the country after a war. Our military leaders were insisting at the time, saying, no, don't disband the Iraqi army, you know, keep them intact, you know, arrest the, what's the party, Mabahar, party man, Bahar. Baathist party, you know, but the army, leave it alone. The State Department insisted that, no, we're going to disband the Iraqi army, and that's what we did. And now you know who the ISIS are, right? They're the Iraqi officers who we have disbanded. So I think that was a very big mistake. But there are lots of mistakes that can go on while it's happening. You know, we're closing our eyes on it, but the Turks are closing eyes on it. The Turks are the one, their government is corrupt, so they're the ones that are buying that oil and continue to sell it down the line. Yeah, that's how ISIS gets funded.
Yes, sir.
When you're talking about playing chess directly with Putin, do you mean directly with the Russian Federation or indirectly with the former Soviet republics like Ukraine and Belarus and Central Asia?
No, it involves the entire region. But I think the two main figures on that chessboard are going to be Putin and Trump. And this is the two kings that are going to be moving all the other figures on the chessboard. And I would like to believe that Trump is going to outfox Putin. He's going to outsmart Putin, and it's going to outmaneuver him. So far, the way I see it, he's be able to outmaneuver him, even during the election times. All these things that Trump did was a very pretentious game type, actor type things, and I think Putin fell for it because he's not used to this kind of a game. So we'll see. Hopefully I'm not wrong, but I could be. You know, the way it says on the brochure, to be honest with you, I'll be honest with you because you look like a smart young man. I can't predict things. You know, the only thing about Russia I can predict, that the next president is going to have hair. Because look, that's the only, everything else non-predictable in Russia. That's the only trend Russia has. Lenin had no hair, Stalin had hair, Khrushchev had no hair, Brezhnev had hair, Gorbachev had no hair, Yeltsin had hair, Putin has no hair, so the next president is going to have hair.
And eyebrows.
And everything else is not predictable. Unpredictable country.
This is political science.
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, that's another thing. Political science. I like the when the political scientists argue with me. Like, first of all, it's not science, let me tell you. Secondly, your political science, you know, you want to predict what Russia is going to do. We couldn't predict the outcome of our elections. Our prediction was by a mile wrong. If you would have been a financial advisor at Goldman Sachs and you predicted the market the way the political sciences here predicted the outcome of the election, they'd be fired. If you'd be an artillery officer and you would miss the target by that much, you know, man of honor, you would have shot yourself, you know. But the political scientists are not. They continue to argue and predict, even though they have predicted everything else wrong and before. So political science is not science.
Captain, this has been an excellent macro view of Russia, but I have a question that's more parochial and more directed towards intra-Russian information. The last time I was there, which was about 15 years ago, the people in Far East Russia were very pleased with the fact that they were very disconnected from Western Russia, from Moscow, and they kind of ran their own operation in the Russian Far East. And that, in some respects, was advantageous to Alaska, because Alaska also felt itself disconnected from Washington, which enabled us to kind of march to our own drum a little bit. And then I was led to believe that in years subsequent, particularly under Putin, and utilizing the budget process, he kind of tried to consolidate power in the Far East. So what is it today? Is it back to a two Russian country, or is it all consolidated under Moscow? Or what's the environment in the Russian Far East now?
It's a very good observation, sir. I believe that, yes, I think that it's a good thing that you're disconnected from Washington. That's a good thing. And Far East is really, if you think about it, there is even a time difference, and so huge that they can't communicate with each other. The problems they have in the Far East is really irrelevant to what's going on in Moscow. And the governor in the Far East, you know, he's a little czar on his own. So, I don't think that, I think that Russia, if we play our cards right, if we play our chess game right, Russia will bankrupt itself like it did during Reagan times, whether it's going to be because of the economy or because of the arms race, because they can't keep up with us. But in order for Putin to stay in, he will have to compete with us in the arms race, and that will bankrupt his country. The country will continue to fall apart. And I think Far East will detach itself from the mainland of Russia, and Caucasus will detach themselves, and the Muslim population will detach, the area where the Muslims are concentrated, will detach themselves from Russia. And Russia should break probably in five more countries, because it's impossible for such huge country, huge land, to be run by one man. And only one man can dictate what's going on in Far East or Siberia or down in the south. It's too far, but you know, it's comical. In Russia, every year, maybe twice a year, Putin addresses the nation. And then he has, like I'm Putin and you're my subjects. They address questions to him, and you know, it's all set up. And the little girl would say to him, oh, I'd like to have a dress for Christmas. And he's like, okay, it's a dress for a little girl for Christmas. You know? And somebody in the Far East, grandma, saying, well, my pensions are not paid. I can't change the light bulb. And so, okay, change the light. You know, and he says, oh, and then they say, okay, well, the light bulb was changed, and a little girl got a dress. And this, you can't run the country like that. You know, but so he can't even run a family like that. My wife doesn't allow me. But somehow people think that he can, and Russians believe only if they would get to him, only if the comrade Stalin would know the problems we're having, everything will be fixed. It just doesn't work like that. So it's bound to be doomed. It's bound, you know, it won't work. So it's just a matter of time. I don't know. Did I answer your question? Because sometimes I just like answering my own questions. It's a very Russian way of negotiation. You ask them a question and they answer you whatever they think that they should be answering.
I saw an interview with Nemtsov, and actually it was Anthony Bourdain, this food connoisseur, and Nemtsov described Russia as a criminal government. And then, of course, a few months later, he's assassinated, probably by Putin. Would you what exactly is this criminal government? I mean, is it totally Russian mafia, or where is the, who are all these crooks that are running, according to Nemtsov?
Are we being filmed? I just want to say that our government is not corrupt. And it's not criminal. Governments are never criminal. Of course they're criminals. They're a bunch of criminals. They're thugs. Every business now has a KGB officer overseeing it and dictating how. I mean, small businesses. Everywhere they're involved. It's a cancer. The corruption, the crime, it's a cancer. If in the 1990s there was a crime between the mafia groups and between, then now it's centralized. It's a centralized crime. And absolutely, they're absolute criminals. And the KGB, you know, now it's called FSB, but it's still KGB. You can call it whatever you want, SS, KGB. It's still the same people, and they're controlling the lives of everyone, lives of the mass media. You know, if the reporter says something, you know how many reporters are killed in Russia since Putin became president? Over 600 reporters are dead. Officially, no investigations, and political leaders and stuff like this. So, no, absolutely, they're criminals, and it's a mafioso structure, and it's doomed to fail, I think. Can't survive too long. You have to be more pro-government.
There you go. Just to reinforce what you were saying, just with some other information, I read an article a couple years ago that for the average Russian business, the level of bribery within the economy in Russia is equal to the taxation level. So basically you have companies that are paying their taxes, they're paying the same amount in bribes to various officials and other people within the government, and then whatever is left over for them to run their business, and that's what they run their business. So it's endemic throughout the entire economy, I think so.
Hi, thank you. As a historian, I would like to ask kind of a historical question that draws on your experience as the chief of staff for the NATO military liaison mission. So we know that the U.S. position towards NATO and NATO expansion changed drastically. In the late 90s, it was a good idea, everyone on board, NATO's mission has changed, and while we all probably agree that that was a tone-deaf approach at that point, at some point, changed, where all of us, where no longer is the U.S. advocating NATO expansion. And I was wondering if you could kind of, from your perspective, take us through that history a little bit. You know, when did it change? Was Georgia the clincher in 2008, 2009, or whatnot?
Yeah, I think it was Georgia. When the Georgia happened, all of a sudden, it gave fuel for NATO to revive itself. Because before that, we're saying, what's the NATO's mission? Well, to fight terrorism. Well, how does NATO fight terrorism? It's another, you know, terrorism is not an enemy. It's not the enemy. Terrorism is a tactic the enemy is using. That's where the confusion comes. And, you know, my grandfather did not say, oh, during World War II, I fought Blitzkrieg, you know. He would say, you know, he fought not even Nazis. He didn't call them Nazis. You know, he called them Germans. He fought the Germans. The Germans were the enemy. And many of your grandparents probably said, you know, it's the Japs. You know, it's the crowds, the Japs. That's the enemy. Now it's just terrorism. We're fighting terrorism. You see terrorism anywhere? I don't know who to shoot at. Can't shoot at terrorism. So NATO lost its use. There was no enemy that they were facing any longer. But when Georgia happened, NATO started to revive itself. And now we have over 27, 28 countries in NATO. I don't even know. This every year we add another country. The bureaucracy grows and grows and grows. And who pays for it? That's right. Alaskans pay for it. But you know, we are in the NATO. You know what NATO stands for. You young people should know. You guys know what NATO stands for? You're right. North, yeah, right. But except in the NATO, we ourselves call NATO stands for no action, talk only. Are you taping this? It says NATO, no action, talk only. So. So NATO, you know, and we're paying for it. But whenever there needs to be for NATO to take action, to move troops, the countries that join the NATO are not paying their share. And we say, all right, well, we pay because we're rich. So we'll give the money for your 2% of your budget. Then they don't commit the people. So we end up going bleeding. We end up getting our soldiers killed. And I tell you what, I don't want any of my troops killed. And then when we go and we get killed and we kill them, then those same countries criticize us. So not only we're paying for them, not only we're bleeding for them, not only we're protecting them, then they have the audacity to say, Yankee, go home. So NATO needs to be, it doesn't need the same discipline and the same punishment as UN, but it does. It does need to be, you know, NATO now is building new headquarters at Brussels, and I don't know how many billions of dollars it's going to cost. It's a very expensive project NATO took on. Who's going to pay for it? How much money is it going to cost? New headquarters, beautiful. So, yeah, NATO, there needs to be a readjustment. I don't think it changed ever. When did it change? You're talking about when the Russians are saying we promised them not to expand NATO? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, throughout, so my understanding, throughout the 90s, in Clinton and then George Bush the first, and then the Clinton years, NATO expansion was promoted by the U.S. as, you know, welcome aboard. By the time fall 2013, when negotiations with Ukraine are falling apart, at that point, the U.S. is not advocating Ukraine becoming a member of NATO. That has been, that has, to my knowledge, not been publicly stated by any U.S. state official since Georgia. What was on the table was a particular agreement with Europe, but something far short of NATO membership for Ukraine. And so what I'm, what I'd love to have a better understanding of is when the U.S. backed off of NATO expansion as an accepted outcome for countries in Eastern Europe.
I don't know when we backed off, and I'm not sure if we did back off, because there are strict rules who can join NATO and who cannot join NATO. It's not like any country can say, oh, we want to be NATO, and we say, oh, okay, sure, come in. It's a club, and you have to fulfill your obligations to be part of that club. One of them, your economy has to be strong enough to join NATO. I know that the time frame you're talking about, it was Ukraine and Georgia that are trying to get into NATO. And neither one of their economies are strong enough to, does not meet the criteria. And the second thing is, in order for you to be a NATO country, you can't have disputed borders. And of course, now, Ukraine and Georgia have no chance of joining the NATO because now they have disputed borders because of the Russians, because of Abkhazia and North Ossetia and in Georgia and Crimea and Eastern Ukraine. That's disputed borders, so they can't join now for sure. So I don't know if the United States backed off of it or not, but that, I don't know that, or when it happened. I'm not sure if it ever happened. I didn't answer your question. Your face is like.
Yeah, I just, in your discussions, we seem to be maligning the people of Russia. You know, I mean, they're just another group of people like us. And, you know, to say that all they understand is power, shoot, that's all virtually anyone understands, you know, at a certain point. And, is it our goal that we just want to destroy them, the little third world country with 150 million people and no economy? I just can't see that.
It's because you're a nice guy. I don't think they're like us. I don't think they're anything like us, because I don't think the Arab world is like us. I don't think Russians are like us. They have, to me, a serf mentality, every one of them. Even the ones that are in the opposition, even the intellectual ones, they still have that serf mentality, you know, that slave mentality, because they grew up and they were raised in the environment where there is no generation that remembers what it's used to be like not to be a slave. So they're a slave stock, and it is very, very difficult. And I know we're Americans, we're free spirit, and we want everybody to be like us because we're nice. Why can't you be nice like us and live like us and eat like us and enjoy music like us? No, because to them it's disgusting. To them it's not working very well. So when we went, because I have so much genius in me, I have to spill it all out. So when in the early 90s, many of us, you're one of them, right? We all rushed to Russia, rushed to Russia. I'm almost a poet, too. To help them, to say, okay, now they're going to be part of the civilized society. They were handed down freedom, and they're going to enjoy it. They didn't. The people did not enjoy it. They wanted to revert back to the slavery, and this is what happens to them. They went. No uprising, no protests against it. They're very happy to go back where they used to be. And we're all discouraged because we said, hey, wait a minute, didn't you want to have capitalism? Didn't you want to have freedom of speech? Didn't you want to have all these? Didn't you have nice hospitals, schools? No, turned out to be that they don't want that. Maybe it's because the freedom was handed down. Maybe because Gorbachev said, okay, you're free now. There's freedom of speech, there's free economy is free, go ahead, enjoy yourselves. And they said, okay, they tried it for a few years, and they said, no, it's not for us, and they reverted back. Maybe when you fight for freedom and you bleed for freedom like Ukrainians are doing now, like the Georgians did, maybe that's when you cherish it, when you pay a price for it. When are you given something for free? All right. I'm in. Well, you know, it's we won't be able to change them, even if we do that. They will resist, and I think the military force is no longer the answer to many of the problems in this world. I think the economy is the answer more than anything else.
I think we have time for one more question, so.
Please, one more question. You said you can't predict the future. My question, of course, is you predicting it. North Korea has a nice new rocket that goes a long way and a mushroom cloud producing hit. When do you think they'll send them this way?
Well, I predict never, but yes, they do. And unfortunately, we're watching North Korea, and hopefully I trust the government to watch them very closely. North Korea is not only being watched by us, it's also being watched by the Chinese, and North Korea has other difficulties. What it is, maybe we should stop helping other countries to develop that, because now Iran has developed a nuclear, and Iran is developing a ballistic missile, and they will have no hesitation to launch one at Israel. Israel probably will deflect that, but then launch it on them. And Israelis don't have a nuclear weapon, but if they have to, they'll use it. So then we're going to have this mess. Now, the Turks, what the Turks are saying? The Turks are now saying is like, hey, if Iran is going to have a nuclear weapon and Israelis have a nuclear weapon, we're Turks should have a nuclear weapon too. We Americans at the same time saying we don't need a nuclear weapon anymore. Why? Because we have precision weapons. And a nuclear weapon is an outdated weapon. So it is a sort of a mess. My problem is that we keep, if you stepped on the rake once, fine, it happens. With the North Korea, it happened. We were guaranteed that they weren't going to develop a nuclear weapon. All kinds of documents were signed. Clinton was very proud of that. Turned out to be a lie. Now we have another problem with Iran. And what can I tell you? When I'm in charge, all of this is going to stop, I promise you.
And he's also assured me that he will not give Alaska back to the Russian Federation.
Thank you very much.